are posted outside and in the clerk's office and available for your inspection. There are three matters which are set for oral submission today before the court. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Carlos L. Correa versus the First Court of Appeals on original mandamus proceeding combined for oral argument with Jack Carter, Chair of the Harris County Democratic Executive Committee versus the First Court of Appeals also on original mandamus proceeding. The court has allotted 30 minutes for relators to present their arguments, 30 minutes for respondents to reply, and 10 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel have reached agreement on how to allocate that time. Thank you. Second cause is Brenda Llewellyn versus Carl and Melba Llewellyn from Hunt County. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. The final matter is the General Land Office of the State of Texas and Commissioner Gary Morrow versus Oxy USA, Inc. A direct appeal, 20 minutes for argument for each side has been allotted with 10 minutes for rebuttal. The court will take a brief recess in between each of these presentations, but we will complete the submission before we break for lunch. Counsel in the second and third matters are not required to remain in the courtroom, but please stand nearby. All of you are advised that these arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. Should you desire to listen to the tapes of this argument, of any argument, you may make application to do so with the clerk of the court. The court is now ready to hear oral argument from the lay court.
May it please the court, Mr. Andrew Jefferson and Mr. David Webb will present arguments for petitioners. Mr. Andrew Jefferson, will open.
Thank you, ma'am. May it please the court. As I look at the matter now before the court, it is my job to convince the court to restore at least two names, two signatures, which have been disallowed in the Court of Appeals. Upon quickly reviewing the filing of the respondent in these proceedings, having only recently received a copy of his filing at this level, it appears that he takes issue with that position and would say to this court that your responsibility is to look at even those signatures or those areas not touched upon by the Court of Appeals and not examined by that court in its opinion. I will therefore argue it both ways. A word about the record. I think at this time both sides are in agreement that the record before you is complete, although it is certified by the lawyers and not by the court, as ordinarily would be the case since the Court of Appeals was closed for the weekend and for the holiday on Monday, from and after the time the court decided the mandamus action on Friday last. Now, let me talk about my two names. The way I see it, the Court of Appeals decided the case on the basis of considering some of the objections made by the candidate Shipley to the extent of saying that 35 names could be invalidated because those names are names of unregistered voters. 33 names should be invalidated because those 33 names consist of signatures where the signatory indicated his or her city of residence but did not indicate the zip code of the residence or for the neighborhood or for the block, and a group of people who signed the signatures to the petitions indicating their zip code but not indicating the city of their residence. That category makes up 33 names, and I call that the no city or the no zip code category. Be careful in reading the respondent's filing, that is Shipley's filing, because there's a reference to a category labeled no city and no zip code. There's only one such invalidation in this case. There's only one reference made in the Court of Appeals to a signature where there was neither the city of the residence indicated nor the zip code indicated. The 33 names of concern here are names where the signatory either omitted the city or the zip code, but in all of those cases either the city was indicated or the zip code, so you have a clear indication of the city where or the location where these 33 people reside. Then there were four names where the court below invalidated the signatures because of a claim that either the petition did not contain a date or that the date of the signature was incomplete. In my view, I pick up my two names at a minimum in the area where the Court of Appeals found no date or an incomplete date. I cannot fathom why the Court of Appeals for the First District did not follow the Court of Appeals for the 14th on this issue. For the 14th Court of Appeals had held that on this date issue, you can determine the date from the other dates on the same page of the petition submitted by the candidate. And if the first court in this case had done that, it could have easily been determined that these four dates, these four signatures were dated on the date that appeared either just before or just after the question signatory, the signature on the petitions, or at a bare minimum by the date on which the circulator made his oath or her oath before the notary public as required by law. So that consistent with the decision in Leal against Mather, you can determine the date from the page of the petitions on which these questioned dates or incomplete dates appear. And then there was a category of eight names invalidated by the Court of Appeals. Those eight names involve five names, I believe, where the voter registration numbers were not placed on the petition, and I believe three names where the numbers were incorrect. Those eight names are tied very carefully, if Your Honor, please.
Excuse me, in this first category, how many did they invalidate simply because the date was incomplete or missing?
Four. And sent on my primary position, we need two. I can pick up the two in that four.
With a couple of spares.
Or you can give us two of those and we'll be happy. There's a lot to get on down the road. Now, in the filing just made this morning by the respondent takes position that you ought to open up all of these categories in spite of the fact that the Court of Appeals of Houston did not go beyond the categories I've just identified for you, basically. There are a couple of ones here and there, one with no signature, and I've not talked about that, and one where, as I said before, there's no city and no zip code. But I've given you the major categories. The respondent would have you, at this level, examine areas not examined by the Court of Appeals of Houston. And I'll talk about the major area as I see it. Their major area identified in the pleadings filed today has to do with the failure of the petitions to contain the name or the signature in an identical form to the names and signatures which appear on the official registration record. First problem with that, that category, let me just identify the area of dispute and then go back down the line and talk about my view of the law and the facts on each one of these categories. The category of 92 will be what I call the no matching category. That is, the name or signature on the petitions are alleged not to match the names and signatures on the official voter registration records. All right, now, I've said a couple of times now that I want two names and I'd like to have them from the category identified as dates missing or incomplete dates. And I told you that I want to rely on Leal against Mather and say that where you look at a page of the petition and you find a date that's missing, if you look at the date of the signatory just before and the date of the signatory just after the question date, then you can supply the date. And moreover, you may look at the bottom of each petition and page of the petition and see the date on which the circulator certifies and swears to the accuracy of the signature and the data contained in the block next to the signature, that is to say, the bottom of the page and the date on which the petition was notarized and sworn to by the circulator.
The constitutional argument or your co-counsel?
The constitutional argument I believe to be very critical, but I know I've read cases from this court and all courts for many years. I know that courts are loath to decide constitutional issues if you don't have to. And I think as a practical matter, you don't have to get to the constitutional issue. But I'm going to argue it before I sit down anyhow, unless I work my way out of time. The way we've divided this up, Mr. Webb's going to concentrate on that, but I'll say a word or two about it. But I want to be as practical as I can. I say give him my two names from the list of four, and we're out of here, and you don't have to concern yourself with Anderson, no Pilcher. But we will talk about it. Now, if you're honest with me.
Is it fair for us just to review what the Court of Appeals did and give you two names and send you on?
I think so.
Don't we have to go back and look at the other? We force the Court of Appeals to search through the whole petition.
As I read your cases, and I've read Strake pretty thoroughly, Strake against First Court, which told me how to get up here. And as I understand what you do in the circumstances, it's not a straight appeal. You are trying to determine whether the First Court abused its discretion. And that determination is based on the record before the Court of Appeals. You're not another trial court, as I see the legal situation, starting anew from scratch. If that were the case, certainly all these categories would be fair game. But you are trying to determine, under your own law and your own decided cases, whether the First Court abused its discretion on the record before it at the time it made its decision last Friday. As I say, to be on the safe side, I got to argue it both ways because I don't know what view will carry a majority on this court. But in any event, my view is that what you are looking at is what the court did on the record it had to decide whether in invalidating 85 names that court acted properly, because that court didn't reach these other names. But I'll talk about these other categories. I've identified the major one, which has 92 names in it, the so-called not matching category. Because if you agree with me on the 92, and the 33, in my view, as I count the numbers, we're over the hump in any event.
Why shouldn't strict compliance with this the requirements of the petition be required rather than substantial compliance? Wouldn't that be an easier rule for the parties and the courts?
Well, you're dealing with, sure, it's easy. You know, a lot of things are easy, but our work is not that easy. We can't find an easy touchstone and say easiness is the rule. At least I hope we don't start with this case. Certainly there might be all kinds of things the legislature might have put in the definition of address, which is our concern here. Suppose they said you got to add your Social Security number. Suppose they said you had to add, in the case of veterans, your military ID number. Suppose they said any number of things that all of us might agree is ridiculous, irrational. Legislators have no place telling voters and their candidates that they've got to put completely ridiculous information on a voter nominating petition. You see, I think we could agree if we had these extreme cases. Now, the zip code as a requirement on a petition where you've already told everybody what the city is and what the state is and what your voter registration number is, why should a zip code be required as a matter of law? And that's how come courts get to review what legislatures do. And I say that in the ordinary circumstances, since we're talking law, you might say strict compliance ought to be the rule, but there are all kinds of areas where courts require, and in important areas, nearly everything we lawyers can do is important. And there's so many areas where all the time you talk about substantial compliance. You talk about the substantial evidence rule. I mean, when you're over there talking about oil and gas and administrative matters and matters of money and property, you're not hesitant at all to talk about substantial compliance. You see, so today I come before you talking about some fundamental. The right to vote, the right to be on the ballot, the right to have your people pass on your qualifications and say whether you ought to be a public official or not. I mean, a subject much more important in my view than any of these other areas where you consistently say we'll take less than strict. If Your Honor, please.
Counsel, the other day on a similar case, one of the lawyers, instead of substantial compliance, argued that we might follow the tolerable flopping rule.
Well, I'm a better lawyer than that. I don't. I don't embrace that. It's not legal terminology. Let me talk about this a little more about the 33 names. As I told you before, those are the names where the signatory has either put down his or her city and left off the zip code, or put down the zip code and left off the city. This Dunn case that you already know about appears to have left the decision on the zip code issue until another day. Our court appears to be the only court that's gone this far, that is the First Court of Appeals, in invalidating names where there's no zip code but where there is a city designated. And I say it's just redundant to have said you got to put down both the city and the zip code. And on that score, I ask the court to follow the rationale contained in the concurring opinion in Dunn, where that recognizes the capacity of courts to apply common sense from time to time in the interpretation of even its election statute, and to give us if I need two, then I just want you to give me enough out of the, put the city down in no zip code to get me over the 250 hump.
There's a line of cases that says that doubts about eligibility should be resolved in favor of eligibility.
Yes, sir.
In spite of those, I haven't seen.
I have not. And we're in a world that this man...
I tried them successfully in my last dissenting opinion.
Well, I've agreed with every one of your good opinions. And that sounds like another one of them. But I certainly agree. We're talking, as I say, we're talking basic stuff here. We're not talking about, hardware. We're talking about...
Do we have any that have zip codes and no city on it?
Yes. In the group of 33, they're bunched together as 33. If you've not seen it, what I did, there's an attachment to Korea's response to Shipley's amended mandamus petition, where I took their listing of registration numbers, wherein they claimed that there was no city indicated, but that there was a zip code, and where they claimed that there was no zip code, but the city was designated. And in parentheses, after each one of those registration numbers, I have set out what in fact exists on these petitions. And so that list of 33 contains names where there's a city and no zip code. Names where there's a zip code and no city.
Did you take judicial notice that the zip code is the same as Houston?
Yes, I would hope so. The zip code, in most instances, is 77020. And I don't think there's any disagreement but what that's in Houston. You see, the county's identified, Harris, and the state's identified. So with the county, the state, and the zip code, you know where the city is.
You want to talk about those three that you brought up can put you over the...
Well, I started out with those. I call them four of those. And they're the ones where the other side claims that four people should be invalidated because either the date was missing next to their signature or the date was incomplete. Say like 1-2 but not the year, or 12-31 and not the year. But where the signature just ahead of that had 12-31-89 or 1-2-90 or some date, and then the one after it, just after it, has 12-31-89. And then on the bottom where the circulator swears before the notary that he or she has done her job, that date's January the 2nd, 1990.
Are there any cases...
And that's Liel against Mason.
Are there any cases where the date is after the date of the affidavit?
Yes.
At the bottom?
Yes.
I mean, where it's later?
Yes. And you look on my Exhibit 8, page 2, and I've analyzed those no dates or incomplete dates in parentheses after each one of those registration numbers so that you see what each one of the petitions contain.
I have a housekeeping. You and Mr. Webb have agreed to split your time.
We have.
Notified the marshal of that.
We have, and the green light's supposed to come on in 20 minutes for me, and then he's going to come on.
Okay.
All right. For an example, over on page 2 of my Exhibit A, on the first one, I've indicated there's no date, but the circulator's affidavit is signed on 1-2-90, and it appears below signatures dated 1-1-90. And then there's no date on another, but the circulator's affidavit is dated 1-2-90, and the signature appears between two other signatures dated 12-31-89, and so on. But you have to find that little exhibit. All right. Now, that's all I'm going to say about those 33. Now, remember, the city is on part of the 33, and the zip code's on the other part of the 33, and I say after all those 33, they ought to be validated, because that makes sense. And that's invalidating. Because saying the city and the zip code redundant, saying the zip code and the city is redundant. They both say the same. Say, where does the fellow live? Where does the lady live? Live in Houston or in zip code? As designated, Your Honor?
A clarification on that issue. The Court of Appeals, in footnote 2, says they're not deciding the issue of whether a partial zip code is sufficient.
I'll talk about it right now.
All right. And then, but then on the next page, they say that they've invalidated the people that don't have a complete zip code.
No, that's not what I guarantee that's not what it's saying.
Okay.
Footnote says they're not deciding the question whether a partial zip code is adequate. That is, a case where the city is shown and the zip code is shown as 20. You know, and the argument was that that's a commonplace reference, you see. Now, they might come up here and argue that you ought to not, you all, you know, now, in spite of this sound discretion review issue, you all ought to decide that the partial zip codes are invalid. Well, the argument there is this is commonplace. Imagine you've told somebody in your life, when I ask you your zip code, you say 02. I say 04. All over Houston, we know what 04 means. I imagine some of y'all from Houston know what 04 means. That means out here where I live. You know? And so when you say 20, but the court says we don't decide that partial zip code issue. And if you should, I hope you understand that 20 is a way of designating a zip code. I'm about to finish now. The 35 names on the petition, I've argued that those 35 names, well, let me tell you what you got. You got a so-called petition. You know, it doesn't say I'm the custodian of the records. It doesn't say that I cause the official or public records of Harris County to be examined by someone under my supervision and control, and I therefore certify the following, you know, like lawyers talk. It says instead that I certify these 59 people do not appear on the current list of registered voters. Now, what does that mean, current list? The law says, 1.41 says, the critical time is the time that the petitions are signed. And this so-called affidavit doesn't speak to that time, if it is an affidavit. And we say it's not, so it's not an affidavit form. Moreover, my exhibit number A, I believe it was, it's that affidavit from a lady named June Gibson, just shot holes all through this so-called affidavit. I went over there and sat down with this lady shoulder to shoulder, and we looked at the computer screen. We saw these names come up, and sure, Ms. O.L. Peavy has signed the petition as Mrs. Otis, but she's registered as O.L. and O.L. signed it as Otis, and he's registered as Mr. O.L. and things like that. But the registration numbers are the same. The addresses are the same. And that's those 24 names, of course, deserves credit for those. On the constitutional issues, I'm taking a couple of minutes from David's time. I think Anderson controls, Pilcher controls. The argument is that, well, those cases we're talking about parties, and the association, freedom of association of members of a party, of people sharing a common political view, but we've never said party over individual. We're talking here about the individual right of a candidate and those people with whom he associates through these petitions to have their candidate's name placed on the ballot. And so the constitutional standards which apply in those circumstances, that is, if you had the party as in Pilcher or the individual independent candidate as in Anderson, the principle would apply in this case as well. We have a candidate. We have 333 people who want him on the ballot. Those are his political associates, and they're entitled to have his name on the ballot without having any unreasonable burdens placed in their path. And we'd urge upon the court the rule in Anderson and in Kosher. And I'll yield for questions. Otherwise, I'll yield to Mr. Webb.
Thank you,
Senator. Thank you.
Okay, please, the court. I'm David Webb, here for the chair of the Democratic Party of Harris County, Democratic Executive Committee of Harris County, Jack Carter. And I'd like to make it clear that we are here to support our candidate, Carlos Correa. He is the candidate of the Democratic Party. We are here.
Are we talking about a contested primary?
Yes, we are. I was just going to say, Your Honor, we're also here, with all due respect, to our candidate, Donald K. Shipley, who's making this challenge, saying that we believe we've correctly placed his opponent, Carlos Correa, on the ballot. Most obviously, we are here seeking guidance from this court as to how we may best administrate primaries. And some of you know firsthand, in Harris County, to run for a judicial office, you have to have a petition of 750 signatures if you do not pay the filing fee, and of 250 signatures if you do pay the filing fee. That was enacted by the legislature a few years ago. That means, for example, if we had 20 judicial candidates out of the approximately 40 that we have each 2 years in Harris County, who didn't pay the filing fee and filed 750 signatures, if they filed only the 750, we would have to check 15,000 signature blocks for these bits of information. Now, on the face of it, all of those blocks might be filled. There might be a date there, a zip code, a city, a signature, printed name, voter registration number. But of course, a challenger has the right to check that information and determine whether or not it is wrong. If we are put to the strictest of tests, we, in administration of the party, and of course, be it the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, or the Libertarian Party, or other, should check every bit of that information, not just see that there is an address, but verify that it is Dorothy Smith's address, for example. And yet, in terms of the problems of strict compliance, I'd like to make a point with reference to the signature blocks that are before you, the printed form that's before you. Although the law has been construed to indicate residence address, referring back to Election Code 1.05 and its definition, in fact, the petition block simply says in English, street address or route number. Now, some have been challenged this season, and I don't believe they appear in this case, because someone put their business address there. Now, that's not what it says in Spanish. And one of my failings is I took Latin instead of Spanish, but I am told by the candidate, Mr. Correa, that the proper word would be domicilio in Spanish. The Spanish says residencia, which is at least arguably more accurate than the English in instructing someone what to do. So there are even problems with the form. The other problem that I want to point out with the form itself, the petition form as issued by the Secretary of State, is that the size of the block for city and zip code hardly allows room for most people. Now, this may be blown up in the form that you have it, but in petitions as circulated on the form that come out, hardly allows room for you to write in Houston in a zip, much less the name of a longer city. Basically, people write over the printing to do that. Hyper-technicalities, and you were told I was going to speak about competition, but I think it's important to address some of the problems of very strict compliance. I think a strong case could be made for very strict compliance in some situations. Problems of lack of personnel as staffed by the legislature through the Secretary of State's office and provided for the primaries in Harris County simply don't allow us enough people to comply in the strictest sense with reviewing these things in the first place.
Do you agree that the legislature may constitutionally require 750 signatures in these races if a filing fee is not paid?
First of all, I know there was a footnote by Justice O'Connor that indicated that we waived that in oral argument. I don't believe that was the case because I don't believe we discussed it. What I said in oral argument was I thought there had been legislative reasons that could be considered valid why that requirement was passed. We simply have not taken a position on that issue.
On whether it's constitutional or not.
Yes, sir.
And likewise, you don't take a position on whether it's constitutional to require 250 names if there is a filing fee paid.
No, sir. No, sir. We do take a position on the strict construction as it relates to constitutionality, as you've seen in what we filed with you. We believe that the Pilcher case, while it had to do with the Libertarian Party, and is distinguished by the majority in our case below for that reason, has equally to do with this group of voters who associated to sign petitions for Carlos Correa or any other petition candidate. First Amendment speaks in the phrase freedom of association. I don't see a distinction in people associating to support an incumbent judge they want reelected, associating to support a judicial candidate they would like to see elected on the one hand, and associating to form a party, such as a Libertarian Party, on the other hand, from the standpoint of the meaning of freedom of association. Secondly, it seems to me that the Pilcher test appears to be the law. As you know, it came out of the Western District of Texas, an approving opinion by Judge Nowlin. And it also seems to be a reasonable test to apply to the dilemma in which we find ourselves in trying to review these ballots and have them contested. Whether one calls...
So your view is if substantial compliance is all that's required, that does not impinge too directly on constitutional rights such as freedom of association, but if a strict compliance is required, that does.
Well, I would have to know what is meant by substantial compliance. I think the point in Pilcher is if you can go to voter registration records and verify that someone is a registered voter, then his or her signature block would count toward that candidate's or that political party's petition. And that is something that we could certainly live with. I see my time is up. I would like to address, if I may, just for a moment, briefly, the issue as we had understood it on the difference between a candidate who is off the ballot for a failure of form, content, or procedure per the sections we're talking about, and constitutional ineligibility.
We
simply need clarification.
The court would be interested in hearing your argument on that, but you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Do you mind if I ask a question now, or if not, I'll ask you to say it for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you.
There being no questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Farmer.
May it please the court, Ms. Deborah Tyler and Mr. James Stafford will present arguments for the respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Deborah Kaiser, and I, along with James Stafford, represent Donald Shipley in this matter before the court today. First of all, I would like to answer Mr. Jefferson's contention that all he needs is for y'all to give him two little names and he's going to go home happy. I believe that that is not the issue that's before you today. The Court of Appeals invalidated a certain number of signatures that got them below the 250 mark. At that point, they determined that they did not have to go farther. That there was no determination that further issues were without merit, or if they hadn't reached that 250 mark with the issues that they decided upon, that they could not have gone farther. And so for them to stop at 248 and us to have invalid signatures remaining, and then have Mr. Jefferson be able to run up here and get two little signatures placed back on here just seems patently unfair.
How was the record presented in the Court of Appeals? How were all these fact questions presented in the Court of Appeals?
Most, they were presented by attached exhibits, attached to Donald Shipley's First Amendment petition for writ of mandamus. There was the first attachment was the certified list of Mr. Correa's petitions. The second exhibit was one that was attached to the petition for writ of mandamus itself, which was an exhibit that listed all the various voter ID numbers, the page number on referencing Exhibit A, and the slot that they signed in, and grouped in accordance with how they were facially defective.
Did the parties stipulate as to the accuracy of that?
No, the parties did not stipulate to anything.
Did the Court of Appeals take testimony, or how did they decide who was right about what the problems were?
Most of the issues were apparent on their face. For instance, their finding on no city, no zip code, of course, All they had to do was look at the attached petition, and it was there or it wasn't there. In cases in which we had a group of signatures that Carl Smith's office declared were unregistered voters, that was attached as an affidavit as Exhibit C on our petition, and Carl Smith had taken Exhibit A, all of Carlos Correa's petitions, personally examined them, and presented an affidavit of 59 persons that were not registered to vote that were included within Mr. Correa's petition.
Let me ask you a question. If on the petition there is a name, everything's on there except the zip code, but when you go to the computer screen, you see that exact name, and it, of course, has the zip code on it. Is that a good signature or a bad one?
My understanding is that Carl Smith would not have said that that was a bad zip code. And basically, as I understand the computerized voter registration roll, they're done by name. And so most of the problem came up when the name was different on the petition than what had actually appeared in the voter registration. Either people's first names, they Ramon instead of Rudy, or there were a lot of different situations. And so in those particular instances, those were people that Carl Smith said were not registered to vote. If when he punched in the name that was on the petition, it did not come up with anything.
If the name was exactly the same as it was on the petition and on the computer, he said those were good, no matter whether the town was wrong, the zip code was wrong, or any of that was left off.
He really didn't address the town of the zip code. There were some instances in which the street address was different, and not just, and it was different and out of that precinct, that voting precinct. If the my understanding, and this is not included within the record, but was that if there was a different address, but if that address was included within the same voting precinct, then they did verify that as a registered voter.
Well, wouldn't it be enlightening to have Mr. Smith's testimony tested by cross-examination on whether he did this or not, or whether he just willy-nilly decided, I think this is in and this is out? Well, wouldn't that make a big difference to us in deciding this case?
I imagine his method for searching would be interesting to assist in determining. But I think the issue is whether or not Mr. Correa's petitions were facially defective.
Is this rule to protect, who does this rule protect? The people of Texas or the people of Harris County, the parties? Is this a rule that is just directed to the administrator of the party, and if he's satisfied there's enough signatures, then he or she, then that's good enough, and the court should just stay out?
What is it, a political question or a legal question?
My understanding is that it's a legal question, and that the law has held that there should be strict compliance with the filing of, with filling out a petition.
There hasn't been a single case that I know of decided under the Harris County judicial petition rule that is held absolutely strict compliance until these cases
Dunn.
Came on.
I believe the Dunn decision, both the majority opinion and the concurring opinion, stated very forthrightly that strict compliance was mandatory with the provisions of the election code.
Mr. Kaiser, let me ask you a question with regards to the standard of review. Mr. Jefferson takes a position that the standard of review for this proceeding is abuse of discretion. We are to look at what the Court of Appeals did. And this is why, this is the basis of his argument. All he needs is two names because the Court of Appeals says that he had 248 that were valid. Now, you're arguing, if I understand your position, Mr. Jefferson is wrong. This is a proceeding in the nature of a new trial de novo, and we are to go back and look at all of the names the Court of Appeals did not look at. Is that your argument? So it's not, the standard review is not abuse of discretion, but a trial, we start anew, like a new trial, or...
I understand what you're
is
saying.
That your argument?
I wish I had a real enlightening answer for you. I kind of want
it
both
yes
ways.
Or no?
I agree that, that the standard of review is abuse of discretion, but I just don't feel that it, it was the intent of the Court of Appeals to block off any further court's review of specific areas of error just because they did not find it necessary to address them.
So you are asking us to go beyond the Court of Appeals and look at all the other matters?
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
So it is in the nature of a trial de novo here.
What you're saying is the Court of Appeals does not abuse its discretion if it reaches the right result for the wrong reason.
I guess that is what I'm saying.
Why wasn't this action initiated in the trial court, in the district court?
There was just a time problem when it was filed, and to present an evidentiary hearing, we needed to go ahead and get a quick ruling so whoever was the losing party could take it up very quickly. It was not filed until, it wasn't decided on by Judge Shipley until after all of the issues regarding the judicial selection here in Texas and the redistricting and everything had already been decided. And so that was, that presented somewhat of a timeline for it.
Were any of these complaints brought to the attention of the Harris County Democratic Party before it certified this candidate to be on the ballot?
I'm not certain when it certified that this candidate
was on the ballot. Well, the statute says they have to certify them on, I believe, Saturday after the Tuesday. Second Saturday after the Tuesday filing deadline.
These were brought to the attention of the candidate on February 13th.
February 13th.
Yes, sir.
Which was long after the time that the Harris County Democratic Party had already certified this particular candidate to the ballot.
I guess about a month after. I would point out...
Position, well, I think we ought to get the remedy before you sit in.
Okay, well, Mr. Stafford is going to deal with the constitutional issue and with remedy.
All right, good.
I just wanted to point out to this court that I believe that the Leal case can be distinguished. Mr. Jefferson finds that the Leal case is so controlling on this issue of incomplete or missing dates. And I believe our situation is distinguished from Leal because... And three of our four numbers that we got for invalid signatures, the date was missing completely. Leal didn't have any totally missing dates. In fact, Leal just had incomplete dates that were like 1, 22, and then a 6, something of that nature, where they were almost a complete date and just missing one little number.
How about the Silver case?
As to?
Well, he's relying on the Silver case. You have a response.
On the constitutional ground, Mr. Stafford would respond to that.
Do you believe that the rule should be strict compliance with these?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. I believe that the rule should be strict compliance. I believe that the legislative intent is strict compliance. They have had every opportunity to address this in revision of the election code over a period of time. They have even changed the form just recently on the petitions where they included printing the name of the state. And they... very specifically included a city and a zip code.
Why should not the court take judicial notice of a zip code to record? You know, they're a matter of public records. Now, what's wrong with taking judicial notice of a zip code to record? That's a policy matter.
Well, Harris County includes a lot of cities and a lot of zip codes. It's not like some smaller counties where they're just made up of one city and just a few zip codes, for one thing. And as the concurring opinion in Dunn stated, it's our position that it's not the duty of the opponents or somebody to go out and just get all these little kernels of information and play private investigator and try and somehow backwards put them together to try and verify something that it ought to be verifiable on its face.
What public policy is put forward by strict compliance?
Well, Your Honor, I think one issue is that we give our candidates some nice black and white guidelines to go by. I think if you have substantial compliance, you open a floodgate for litigation on just exactly what is substantial compliance. Does this work well? How about this? I think that
running for office is a privilege and not a right, and that the petition request is not unduly burdensome. It has just a few things that you have to do. The election code is very specific, and so I think that a definitive rule would benefit the candidate. I'm not certain, Your Honor. That is an issue that Mr. Stafford will deal with as to how the large counties compare with the small counties.
Well, isn't it a real question of how the other 252 counties compare to two?
Well, there are more than two counties that are required to do this, as far as I'm concerned.
Counsel, sometimes in dealing with statutory interpretation, you know, the court looks at the evil that the legislature is trying to address. What is the purpose of the petition?
The purpose of the
petition? Yeah, what was the legislature trying to accomplish? What evil are they trying to protect against?
I believe, Your Honor, that they were trying to protect, to ensure the stability of the judicial system by trying to have someone declare their candidacy prior to just the last-minute filing.
The stability of the
system itself, Your Honor, because there were so many people prior to this inaction that were going and filing right at the last minute, some without even any intention to campaign at all, relying on the strength of their ticket and people that pulled as a straight lever to get them into office. And because of that instability and because of the judicial system just being flowing with the tide of whoever was on the top of the ticket, that's when they enacted these rules where somebody had to declare their candidacy ahead of time and do this minimum amount of legwork just to let everyone know that they were on the ballot, what they were running for, and didn't just run in right under the wire.
But Ms. Stafford's
going to
tell me why that's on the
table. I certainly hope so.
I'll look forward to hearing that.
I'm James Stafford from Houston, and I think that the constitutional question is probably the most interesting question before this court. I think there's no doubt in anybody's mind that when the legislature back in 86 originally enacted this was definitely a special interest legislation. Harris County was the only one that had it.
Would be classified as a bracket bill?
I believe so. But then I cited in my response that this court, early back in 1897, back when it was addressing Article 5, Section 1 of our Constitution, basically acknowledged that the legislature duty was to adapt our judicial system to changing conditions so that the needs of the state which might develop in its future growth could be provided for by the legislature from time to time.
Did we cite the Galveston Daily News for that proposition?
No. That was Harris County versus Stewart. And the reason I add that is, as I agree with Justice O'Connor and hers, dissent.
You agree with her that this was basically an incumbent protection act?
It had to be. But why is it wrong for the legislature to recognize that and say our judiciary, the integrity of the judiciary, needs protection? What's wrong with the legislature coming up under Article 5, 1 or 2 saying, hey, we have the legislative power to protect our incumbent judges, to make sure we have qualified judges, and judges who will be qualified in qualifications, et cetera, stay on the bench? What's wrong with that?
I think that an incumbent protection act, which you describe as a piece of special interest legislation, by its very nature poses some burden on the rights of those who want to challenge incumbents?
No. How could it?
Well, you don't think that quibbling over zip codes and whether names have been spelled right or people have used maiden names or nicknames or changed their address, that all those kind of things that you're quibbling over in this case, that suggests any burden on a candidate who wants to challenge an incumbent?
No, because I think that's a whole different issue. I think what I was talking about, what was the intent of the petitions? You're addressing, are we going to have strict compliances by what the election code wrote as to the validity of the signatures? And I believe the validity of the signatures even applied to the independent parties and the other parties of possibly getting on the various ballots as well. The determination is, if you're going to assume, one, that it is all right for the legislature to determine that certain judges or certain races have to sign a petition, then what kind of petition and what is the validity of that petition? And how far are we going to construe it? We're going to say substantial compliance or strict compliance. I don't see anything wrong with it at all. And I don't know how the special interest rule would apply to that.
Would it apply if 10,000 signatures were required?
I think as under, you're getting into the Pilcher category, of where I think that was 35,000 signatures. Here okay. We're talking about 250 signatures. It's a very limited, it's to a person who is a lawyer, who's a judge, who's supposed to be able to understand the law, the ramifications of the law, and follow the law.
Well, how about a poll tax or a literacy test for voting in judicial elections?
Well, the question on that, would the legislature have the authority to, under Article 5.1, to do that? They've always had the right to formulate the election code for any and all races.
Why should they be allowed to single out judicial races to the detriment of executive and legislative branch races?
Well, that's the question you got to answer. Do they have the right to do that? I don't know. I really don't. I think there's a very serious constitutional question, is that do the larger counties, because it's a problem, and for any of us to say it is not a problem, because I've always said to everybody, first of all, I'm a lawyer. Second of all, my politics is really irrelevant. I think as lawyers, we owe it to keep the most qualified judges on the bench that we can, be it the Supreme Court or down at the JP level.
Well, and you said this is for the big counties, and it obviously started there, but this is going to apply in Waller County also, isn't it?
That I don't know, Your Honor.
Well, Waller County is within the Court of Appeals district involvement. The same statute covers a candidate from Waller County who wants to run for the Court of Appeals. That includes Harris County.
My understanding, he doesn't have to get the signatures from Waller County. He would have to get them over in Harris County.
Well, that's an even greater burden, is it?
Well, no, because he's got four counties there to run in.
I'm questioning whether this big county, little county distinction has even been observed as to this statute, because it doesn't cover just Harris County or just big county.
I understand that, but I think the original legislative intent basically went to the trial courts substantially more than it probably did to the appellate courts.
What do we have? I realize this proceeding apparently started up late and quick, but what do we have in the way of legislative intent? Our legislative history of this special interest legislation is involved here.
I think it's probably the more accurate set out is in Justice O'Connor's portion of the legislative.
That all, there's nothing that has been breached on that?
No, Your Honor. None that I have found as far as the content. I think
it's just your common understanding that it's incumbent protection?
No, that's my coinage and some of y'all. The only apparent construction of that would have to be that. But the next question, though, does the legislature have the right to protect the integrity of the incumbent judiciary in the larger counties when the apparent problem, as we all know, of people from the big counties is that the average voter, as long as we're going to keep our judges in politics, and it seems that our Senate and legislature is determined to keep y'all in politics, y'all are going to have to run for office, then there is a major problem.
Well, if they can protect, through special interest legislation, incumbent judges in big counties, what is it that prevents them from protecting incumbent legislators in big counties, something they may have even greater interest in?
Well, that's a possibility, but that's not before the court at this time.
You don't have any
possibility since the legislature wants single-member districts, is it?
Well, that is true. If our legislature put our judges in single-member districts, then there probably will not be any necessity for the 250 signatures. I pray on my legal knowledge that we will never force our judges into such a horrible system, but our legislature is getting ready to be in session, and God only knows what they'll do to us. But
how about some unelected federal judge forces them to do it?
Does that
help your prayers then?
Well, that's one of the reasons this petition was filed kind of late, Your Honor. It was because we didn't know whether we were going to have to file from a district or at large or what.
Well, you knew that before the deadline.
Well, it wasn't until the mandate, I think the mandate was issued January 15th, somewhere in there, substantially after.
Wow, this is all interesting, I guess. But I'd like to hear a little bit about remedy, Faye.
Well, remedy in what regard? As far as what I want you to do for me?
Can the ballot be effective at this juncture for the March 13th ballot? Or is Mr. Correa on the ballot regardless of how this court rules? And then, based on our ruling, if he wins the primary, what happens? If he loses the primary, what happens?
Well, the first recently addressed that issue based upon one of your footnotes in the Sears opinion that came out on Valentine's Day, that they're of the opinion that they have continuous jurisdiction. I think McSpadden versus somebody, they granted leave and saying they have continuous jurisdiction. And we're of the position that that is a question that hasn't been resolved by any court as to what our remedy is. It's our position that this court has the power to order the Harris County Democratic Party to supply marks a lot to all the precinct judges to delete the relator's name from the ballot if that is what the court wants to do.
Even though absentee balloting has already started.
Yes. That's our position. I believe the court has that authority. I think the next problem is, if you don't buy that position, is that on canvassing the vote, and if he won, for example, and we lost, then I think it would probably be up to the executive committee at that time to appoint a judge to take over the position.
Do you have statutory authority to do that, or
no,
that
sir.
Sound reasonable?
I have no statutory authority, but that would definitely create a dilemma. My personal gut reaction, if the voters voted him in, but he's not qualified, then I can't see under natural logical construction that Shipley would take the ballot. I think the executive committee would have to probably...
Are you saying not qualified or not eligible?
Not eligible. I used the wrong terminology. But very briefly, my light's on. We are asking for strict compliance. I believe the law, we ask for guidance. There's been more suits filed this year, just rapidly. The Court of Appeals now are taking the position, for reasons unknown, that strict compliance is in.
Are there other cases?
McSpadden.
Those of us who might be planning on leaving town.
Well, there's a couple of this that was decided yesterday. Well, there's one decided by the first yesterday. And the first also is granted leave to hear oral arguments, I think, tomorrow on McSpadden versus another case. So there's a couple more I know that possibly could be coming up your way. And we need to know from you. Are you going to hold our feet to the fire? Or what are the candidates required? Is it unconstitutional? Now's the time to decide. Our position as the legislature has been in session several times since the enactment of this. If they wanted substantial compliance, they had a very easy pen in hand and a willing governor who would have said substantial compliance is okay, but they have not chose to do that. I guess they're going to pass the buck to y'all.
They have certainly got the election code in mess.
Are all of the cases that you're familiar with that are through the system, are they all originating out of Harris County?
It appears that we're the one that's creating most activity.
And in terms of your argument for strict compliance, policy-wise, it centers on easiness of administration and certainty so as to avoid litigation.
Yes.
Are those the only
interests? Maybe the only public policy.
And in terms of those public policy interests, I suppose that the same interest would be served by having no petition requirement at all.
Of course.
Let me address one thing. In reference to, they were talking about our Carl Smith affidavit. previously, I guess Carl Smith's been in Harris County about as long as Squatty Lyons has, if not longer. Everybody knows he's the voter registrar. And our Exhibit C and their exhibit that they're making reference to give the court example, one of the persons, for example, that they say was registered to vote that Carl Smith says was not, signed the Relator's Exhibit A, which is here. It was certified by the Democratic Party. She signed on his petition as Sylvia Kempinko, K-E-M-P-I-N-O-K-I. Well, Carl Smith tried to find her and couldn't find her. Well, Judge Jefferson goes over with a little clerk and says, well, let's find out who's registered in the name. Well, they come up with the name of Sylvia Benedez. That's not a fact dispute at all. It is undisputed fact that Sylvia Kempinko signed the petition. It's an undisputed fact that Sylvia Benavez is registered to vote under that number.
Do they have the same number?
They have the same number, but different names.
Can people get married and change their names or go to court and change their
Well, that we don't know. But I mean, the petition speaks for itself. Well, I understand that, Judge.
True. Can get married or can change their names.
I understand that. But when they sign this petition...
Then they shouldn't get married.
No, I'm not saying that. They can get married and change their name. But if the purpose of it is for us to be able to go down and verify where these people are registered voters, we look at the name...
Yeah, but what is the critical date, counsel? You know, this makes them, what is the reference point? What is the critical name that the name's on a map?
Well, it helps people to know and determine where they're... the affidavit here that these people are registered to vote. And if Carl Smith can't find them by under the names that they listed on petition on the Voting Action Act. Time's up.
Any questions? Thank you,
Governor. Thank you.
May I please record Mr. Buck Wood will present the second half of rebuttal. Mr. Jefferson will begin rebuttal.
If Your Honor, please, in keeping with Chief Justice is suggesting a while ago, I'm going to give you a couple of minutes, Mr. Webb, to answer some of those questions you got at the end of the book.
I do have one fact question for Mr. Jefferson.
You'll come up in a minute.
Oh, you're going to?
It's
going to be all three of them.
Okay.
May it please the Court. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. I'd like to, again, make the point. Our candidate in this race also is Judge Donald Shipley. We're not here contesting the constitutionality of
rather than those who are incumbents versus challengers
or those who are successful in gaining signatures because they have popular support and those who don't. Yes, sir. Another point I'd like to make in that regard is, once again, I think the Pilcher versus Raines standard, which is on the books, applies here. I don't see a distinction in freedom of association as we were just talking about, having signature parties or gatherings or door-to-door, be that by whatever means, to gain popular support for a candidate on the one hand and to do it for a party on the other. A point was brought up about whether or not action can be taken now. We have advanced the position and we seek guidance on whether or not Jack Carter as chair of the Harris County Democratic Party any longer can take any action. You know, and as I quoted from...
In seeking guidance, do you have a position on whether he can or he can't?
Yes, and I set it out. We don't think he can. We think he lost it as of midnight last night. Now, the first court in the case below, the mandamus case decided in the first court between these same real parties and interests, took the Sears versus Baud language and directed Carter to declare Mr. Correa ineligible, but didn't direct him to take Correa off the ballot. But there was a distinction between failure of an application. That had to be directed if the code does set that forth.
It's your position that as of midnight last night it's too late to, as it were, use a marks a lot.
That Carter has no authority to take this candidate off the ballot. Yes, sir.
And this court has no authority to order that.
That's my belief under the code, yes, Your Honor.
And so,
Counsel, sorry.
Not quite done with you here. And so from the party's point of view, does it make any difference whether this court rules today or some later time in the future?
Only insofar as we've got the McFadden versus Carter case in the first court. It was filed last Thursday at 5. The court issued an order for us to have briefs in today and oral argument on the 28th of February. That's the only other one I know about.
Mr. Webb, since the Court of Appeal did not order Mr. Correa off the ballot, his name is on the ballot. And the status quo is, if we do nothing, he stays on the ballot. Is that your understanding?
He is declared ineligible, or the first Court of Appeals has ordered
so Carter
to declare him ineligible.
And so is McCorkle. McCorkle's on the ballot. Why
right.
Is this any different?
Well, we believe that Correa has reasons why he should not be declared ineligible as advanced here. But in terms of staying on the ballot...
My point is, the Court of Appeals did not, as I understand the Court of Appeals' mandate, order the party chairman to remove Correa's name off the ballot.
That is correct.
So his name is on the ballot.
Yes, sir. I yield to counsel.
Sure. Any other questions? You might.
Thank you. John, you're a fact question.
You have an explanation. We had this in the Brady Dunn dispute as well, for why so many of the signatures that your client obtained were from people who were turned out not to be registered.
We're talking in that category. You're talking about 35 out of 333.
Right.
And you see, I still don't know from this record what the situation was on the critical date. And the critical date is the date they signed the petition. Dates in December and early January, on the basis of a so-called affidavit dated in the middle of February. So the record is silent on that question.
They could have moved, they could have changed their name.
Could have done anything. I can't tell you what they did because the record doesn't speak to that.
So you're not really conceding that any of those 35 aren't registered?
Not conceding anything.
They hadn't been found to be registered.
See, I had the good fortune of reading the appellate opinion in Dunn that is filled with statements, and Brady, which is filled with statements about what Brady didn't dispute. I disputed everything. Right? So, this is a case that should be tried in some court that can take evidence, and then we'll know what the facts are. Let me race quickly down my list, if you're honest, please, and leave some time for Mr. Wood. First question. On her argument that we've got the category with no dates and partial dates, and that there are instances where there are differences between the Leal facts, we've got three cases here on my Exhibit 3, this little one here with the explanations off to the right, where the year is not shown, but the day and the month are shown, and those are exactly like Leal, and those are three, so I'll take the three instead of the four. I need two. She says I can't have four. I say here are three. I'll take these. The 35 names. Critical date, if you're honest, please. The date the thing was signed. That is, each one of these petitions, December, early February. Can't make that determination on the basis of a February date. She didn't talk much about the 92 names. That's the names don't match category. Nothing in the statute 1.14, 1.063, which says that the names have to match. That statute says you need a signature, you need an address, and you need a printed name, and that's what it says. Basically, it doesn't say that you can't put your present real name down if you're married. It doesn't say you can't put your present real address down if you've moved. And the code, of course, contains all kinds of provisions about what you do when somebody shows up with a voter registration certificate on an address where they don't live anymore. They get to vote, but they get to vote in a different precinct. This is a disputed facts case. And for that reason alone, the court is authorized under the decided cases to deny their relief and to grant our relief here and order the Court of Appeals down in Houston to set aside its order. On the remedy question,
the remedy we want,
if Your Honor, please.
Justice Gonzalez asked, is there a need for immediate action by the court? Now, even though the name is on the ballot, if the Court of Appeals has said he is ineligible, doesn't this not give his opponent a substantial advantage?
Absolutely. This man sitting there deserves to know, is he a candidate or not? He needs to put his whole heart in his campaign. He doesn't need to sit back and say, hey, if I get some votes, they won't count them. He's either a candidate or he isn't a candidate.
Would
and
not.
He needs to know for fundraising. He needs to know so he can pay me. That's how much he needs to know.
Well said. Would that not be something that his opponent could use in advertising?
Absolutely.
That he has been held
absolutely.
To be ineligible? That
absolutely.
Would be horribly damaging?
Absolutely. And so, Your Honor, please, the remedy you want is a mandamus. Thank you.
Any
Ms. Wood, you want to rest up?
May it please the court, I think there's very little time left here, but I think there's one thing that everybody ought to look at here. We got off into this strict construction, literal compliance, or question.
Take several minutes.
Okay, I'm not going to take long because
I'm sure you'll get some questions that were on.
Okay.
My question to you is, what do you want to say?
We got off into this quagmire over questions like, well, do you come into the polling place, I mean the filing location, or the Secretary of State or the party chairman at 6:01 in the afternoon? You've got to be there at before 6 o'clock or before 5 o'clock on a filing deadline. The court started talking about that 50 years ago. Said, we mean it's got to be strict. What the candidate must do has got to be done properly. Those cases, and one that Gray versus Pants and the other cases like that now are really different issues altogether. The legislature simply came and said, we want a petition, and we want an address, and we want some other things. And obviously, we want those because we want to be able to verify if that person's a registered voter. Now, I would be willing to wager, if it were legal, that the legislature never thought about the fact that they also put a definition of residence address over in the definition sections that list out the normal things that all residence addresses have. Apartment numbers, zip codes, cities, P.O. box, and so forth. That's a definitional section over in the definition section. The provision for this set out in 141.063 about what belongs on this petition just says the residence address. I don't think that, I know in arguments on Brady there was some talk about de minimis. I don't think that applies here. If you got 248 signatures, that's not enough. You got to have 250. And I think that is literal compliance and strict construction, and that's what you've got to have. We don't start playing with the filing deadline times. But when you come down to what's got to be on that petition, I don't think the courts should have ever gotten off into this idea of this total literal requirement that everything has to be there. And I don't think that was intended by the legislature. And I think it has obviously gotten us into the mess that you're seeing today of case after case after case. I can hire someone and go run these petitions. I can find something wrong with most of these kinds of petitions. We're asking human beings, many who are not terribly sophisticated, to sign these things, and we're asking people to circulate them. And I just do not believe, as a matter of public policy, that this court ought to be requiring the kind of strict construction that is supposedly required by the Court of Appeals below and the decision in Gray versus Vance.
I have the same question we've had to some other people about the remedy. Is it too late to change the ballot, regardless of how we rule?
I believe it certainly is too late today to do anything.
Does this court say anything about what would happen in the event that who wins the race? I mean, or is that for another case? Let's just suppose in this case that Mr. Gray, that we deny the remedy. He loses, we uphold what the court below has done. But he's still on the ballot. Is there any need to say anything at this time about what the effect of that is? I mean, do his votes count? If they count and he wins, is there a substitute nominee, et cetera?
Your Honor,
I'm not going to write, and we shouldn't be thinking.
I don't think that that's before the court at this point. I have some problems with what was done in Sears, but that's my own personal. The court's spoken, and that's over with. But if we want to re-argue that, I might be interested. But the fact is, I think as of this point, nothing be done for Mr. Perez's name. He does deserve to know whether or not he's a real candidate or something that's left on the ballot.
But the emergency, or the point that Justice Cook asked, your co-counsel about a moment ago.
Yes,
the emergency in this is so that it's so that
he can have
and Mr. Shipley will both know where they
he can have an effective candidate he can't have as of today.
Okay, now I've got a couple questions about the remedy too. If there are fact questions out there that are yet undecided, does that leave us without the ability to grant a mandamus because there are fact questions?
Well, in my practice before this court before, the court has always tried to determine if there was really any dispute about the critical facts. If there are no real disputes about critical facts, I think this court can and has in the past, in cases I've been involved in, gone ahead and made a decision. There are obviously some facts here that could be resolved because of Carl Smith's affidavit and whether it's really an affidavit and where it's, what he really did. I think that if we can look on the face of what is agreed by all parties here, as far as the signatures and the numbers, that this court has enough material in front of it to make a decision.
In other words, if there are some undisputed facts here,
sufficient to allow this court to make a decision, I believe there are.
Is this the kind of decision that appellate courts ought to be making? I mean, is this working to have the Court of Appeals try to sift through the facts for one of these cases?
No, it's not, Your Honor. We all know it's not. I've sat for the last, well, since all these petition cases got started and tried to think of some bright line that we could do, that I could suggest to this court is how we'd solve this problem. I think we're going to probably have to solve the problem and raise the Sears case legislatively, and we're going to have to take a look at that next time. I was a member of the Revision Commission and put all this stuff in here in the first place, so I have to take some of the blame. But it's not something you should be dealing with. This court shouldn't be dealing with these kind of issues on a regular basis. There will obviously be cases in the future that you'll have to deal with, but this kind of cases and the cases that are following it up seem to me to be something that our system doesn't need to vest upon this court or possibly even the Court of Appeals in this situation.
The standard review, abuse of discretion, is part of the Court of Appeals. What our test is that we have to get it back.
I believe that is the standard of review. I guess the question is what makes up that standard of review. For instance, I don't think the fact that we didn't raise a constitutional issue in the, or did or didn't constitutional issue in the Court of Appeals in any way prevents us from raising it here. But I think you stated that your standard of review is the Court of Appeals abuse of discretion, and I certainly agree with that.
But isn't it an abuse of discretion for the Court of Appeals to issue mandamus in a case in which there are fact issues that it can't possibly resolve?
If there are those kind of fact issues in a case, yes, it is.
Is this one of those cases?
I really don't think so, Your Honor. I think there's enough here in front of us that's undisputed that this court can take action.
No, I mean for the Court of Appeals.
Oh.
Isn't it abuse of discretion for a Court of Appeals to issue mandamus in a case where there are fact questions that it can't possibly resolve?
Yes, it is.
But you're not claiming that the Court of Appeals didn't have enough facts to resolve this. You're just saying they resolved it the wrong way.
It is from, and looking at how this court has resolved these cases in the past, there are always some possible fact issues floating out there, but they're not really injected.
They're not material facts.
They're not material fact issues. And I think there was enough before the Court of Appeals for them to make a decision. The problem is, I think they made the wrong decision.
Are there any cases dealing with petitioning requirements in municipal elections, charter revisions, referenda, that sort of thing, that have seen bearing on this?
Not really. This definitional section over there, which said all of these things has created this problem, and the interpretation of that is all being mandatory. In municipal elections and so forth, and rollback petition elections, we've never had that problem. The courts have always said if we can determine whether a person's a registered voter or not, we're not going to disqualify.
And did you waive your 14th Amendment concerns as suggested when Judge Shipley's brief?
No, and I don't think they're waivable, and they weren't waived as a matter of fact.
Any other questions? They're not.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This concludes arguments in the first matter, and the court will take a brief recess.
Please rise.